welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program. I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time.
Hello, I'm Rob Greaves, and welcome to another fabulous program in the Listen to Older Voices series. It seems as though I'm constantly blessed in being introduced to so many wonderful Australians and privileged to be able to hear some of their life stories and share them with you. And in today's program, I present the story of such a person. This is part one of a three-part program featuring the life and times of a wonderful woman with some wonderful stories. Robin Yolton is a baby boomer. Born in 1955 in Brunswick, Robin's story cannot be easily summed up in a few lines. She'll take us on a journey from her earliest memories onward. Born into a loving family, Robin was given the type of parental guidance that helped set her up for life. Being, in her words, a smart little bunny, this actually made life difficult for her in school. Growing up in the swinging 60s, she suddenly found there was a new type of thinking, new music, new ideals. Listen and learn something about Robin, and you'll be back for the remainder of her story, I can guarantee it. Now, here I am, speaking with Robin Yolton.
Well, first of all, Robin, thank you very much for inviting me into your home, and could I start by asking you, whereabouts were you born and when were you born?
I was born in 1955, and I was born in Brunswick, Victoria, Australia, and grew up in Eltham.
1955, now you probably don't remember that year, so what are your earliest memories?
My earliest memories of escaping from the house when I was toddling, so I was probably about two or three, and heading off into the bush.
We could laugh at that, but that would have been serious, because Eltham in the 50s was real bush, wasn't it?
It was real bush, dirt roads, dirt tracks and things like that, and we lived in a very, very bushy area. Apparently I was lost for about 3 hours.
Wow.
And found just sitting under a tree waiting to be retrieved.
Do you have any actual memories of that?
I do, yes, I do. I can actually remember colours, and Mum says, or said, that was what I had on. I had on a yellow sort of little suit thing with a pink bib, because I'd escaped after lunch.
Wow.
I went to walk it off.
Did she? I mean, obviously at that age, you were too young for her to even bother chastising or doing anything. Like, she would have just been so pleased to see you. But did she ever talk about it in later years?
It was always a running joke with when I grew up. You know how things come to haunt you when you're older and you don't want them being told in front of your teenage friends?
Oh, yes.
She'd always tell
the story. Oh, she always did.
Yeah, about how I'd toddle off into the bush and sat waiting under the tree to be rescued.
She must have been so relieved.
She was relieved. Yes. But I was kept on watch after that. I was very inquisitive as a child, and being in the bush, there were lots of things to look at, birds and other creatures you don't pick up, like snakes.
Mm.
And
yes.
There were plenty of snakes in Eltham.
Oh, I bet, yes.
Believe me, yes.
Now, you mentioned Mum. What sort of woman was she?
Absolutely brilliant woman. She'd come from a very rough upbringing. Well, initially it wasn't. Her father was quite wealthy, but unfortunately he had a gambling problem. They were at the stage where they had a two-story bluestone house and they had a car, and in the 1920s that was,
something.
Something,
yes. Yeah.
And unfortunately the money dwindled away with the gambling problem and then he disappeared.
Right.
So I never got to meet my grandpa, but our grandma did it hard. She had three children, and Mum was sort of, the one she looked to help with the two boys. So it was, on the Susso list. I'm sure someone will know what that means.
Yes, the sustenance. That's right.
And, wondering where the next penny was going to come from, because Grandma couldn't work full time because Mum's younger brother wasn't old enough to even go to school when the father took off.
We're on the Susso now. So it was difficult because she had the children on her own, plus it was also the depression and coming into the Second World War when things were very tight.
Yes, very, very. She was very interesting to talk to and told me many, many stories. In fact, it's a pity she's not here to do what I'm doing today to tell you her story. But certainly she worked very, very hard all her life. And subsequently, when she married my dad, she made sure that my brother and I had what she never had.
Mm.
And we were educated at, you know, private schools, and she'd work overtime and you know, six days a week in factories and all sorts of things to get the money to put us through our education.
That's a story that's been told over and over again. It seems as though that was a whole generation suffered themselves, and their main goal was to make sure their own children didn't go through the same thing. And that's your story as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, just some little anecdotes, like she'd say things to me about what they ate. And it was a real thrill to have a dripping sandwich.
Yes.
And it was a real thrill to have a tin of buttermilk.
Yes.
And you think, oh, yuck.
Exactly.
A dripping sandwich. But, yes. You know, that was to be gobbled up, because quite often if it had come from a rich family's home, the dripping had been donated, it would have all the goodies left over from the roast dinners.
Yeah.
So I suppose it would have been quite tasty.
It helps, doesn't it? I mean, because it sort of gives us a perspective on our life now. We take so much for granted now. And the stories like you tell suddenly bring us back to reality of how much struggle really is. People these days, I think, especially young people, have absolutely no idea what struggle really is about. Your grandmother and your mother did.
I'm not being awful or anything, but I think, you know, people get upset today if they can't upgrade their iPod, you know?
Yes.
Or if the chips are a little bit cold or the fries are too cold at Macca's.
That's right.
And they throw them in the bin. I mean, you know, that would be unheard of.
Yeah.
And also, there are a group of children who were born to those people, like my mum and my dad, who, you know, a lot of us still around, thank goodness.
Yes.
To tell the stories of how that's formed our characters. We're kind of a hangover, if you like, from that, where we do appreciate the things we've got.
Yes.
It's the next generation, whatever letter they are.
Yes. I think we're running out, aren't we?
Z or
that's right. I'm quite sure we do after Z.
B minus two. There's a lot of good in everybody, I feel, but they just, you tell them story. I met someone the other day who didn't know we had a $2 note. Now, that made me feel old.
Yes, that's right. I can understand if I hadn't heard about pound notes, but a $2
note. Yeah.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, just be very quiet. But those stories that Mum and Dad used to tell, and then Dad's stories about the war, because he was in the Navy.
Right.
And he'd come from England as a 14-year-old boy, and then at 18, you know, jumped on the boats, and he was in the Battle of the Coral Sea, and, you know, it's a whole different world.
Yes.
It's a whole different world.
How do you think of your dad now? How do you remember him?
A very, very talented man, a very quiet man of few words, but when Dad said something, it was very wise. He was a thinker. And I think a lot of his memories he internalised because they were too painful to talk about.
Yeah.
So, yes. You know, he was a very sensitive man. And, you know, you'd see him listening to music, just sitting quietly in his chair, and a tear would roll down his cheek.
Yeah.
And I'd say, "What's up, Dad?" He'd say, "Oh, something, Maya."
Yes, yes, yes.
But, you know, he was very, very easily moved, especially animals. He loved animals. He'd never see or didn't want to hear about people being cruel to animals. Loved his animals.
Yes.
So a very gentle, sensitive man. At the same time, he had to be strong because of what he grew up with, the transition from England to here, the war, and the struggle too with finances, you know, and he and Mum did it together. They were a real team.
Yes.
And I think my brother and I, we didn't suffer from the odd whack over the ear hole, as Mum used to say, or that sort of thing, just to pull us in line. And we have inherited from them that sense of right and wrong. And, you know, you just don't do things because you think you can get away with them.
And again, like yourself, I don't want to make it sound like that individually or together we're here to pick on the youngest generation of today. But again, you look around you today, and I seem to see this lack of respect, lack of boundaries, lack of understanding of just, you know, what it means to be in a society, and it's just a free-for-all out there. Do you think that children today are lacking from that sort of just that basic home discipline?
I think so. I think there are too many groups. Like there's a group for aftercare after school. Well, when we were kids, we, after a certain age, we'd go home, we'd be by ourselves. We were latchkey kids, but we understood the boundaries. We could play footy down the street till a certain time, then it was go home, peel the vegetables for when Mum and Dad got home, then they cooked the meals. Yes. So there was a discipline, but we understood because we respected our parents. So we weren't, there wasn't a group for this, or, you know, Mum smacked me, so I'm going to divorce my parents,
yeah,
for heaven's sake.
Yes.
Or I can't have an upgrade on my computer, so I'm going to leave home and, yeah, and then get pulled up before a judge and get a slap across the wrist and told not to do it again.
Yes.
You know, it's just, there's no real strong backbone there, I don't think. There's too many groups and too many people who are social workers, or those, I mean, they do marvellous work, but I think there's too much, it's too easy for kids to get away with too much. And they don't have, yes, that foundation of just respect for elders, respect for, there are laws. But, oh, well, we can break that law because Johnny got
12 months.
No.
That's right. Yeah.
So, you know, call me old-fashioned, but I think it's always stood me in good stead. And I've done a bit of teaching during my life, and the kids can be marvellous, or they can be absolutely basically more so lazy and expecting everything to fall into their lap. And that's not how I was brought up.
And this is Listen to Older Voices, Ageless Stories on Ageless Radio.
Talk about teaching, school. You obviously went to school. Yep. What are your memories of school? Did you enjoy school?
I was an insecure sort of little kid in some ways. I liked to learn, and by the time I was about 4, I could read. And I remember Mum taking me down to the school, the primary school, and begging the teachers to let me start school because I was grabbing newspapers, anything I could, I could read. And the teacher said, she's got a photographic memory. You've read her the passage and she can remember it. Or, you know, you've shown her with your finger and then she's looked up the same.
She's not really reading.
Not really reading, but she was.
Of course she was.
So they gave in, so that meant that I was always younger in my classes. Like, I actually also skipped, I went from prep to grade 2 because I was a smart little bunny. And I enjoyed the challenge of learning. Yes, I loved it. I love school.
Did it have an effect on the relationship with the kids because you were always younger, or did they not notice?
Well, sadly, having said I love school, I was a bit scared sometimes to be at school because I was, back in those days, if you wore glasses, it was an aberration.
That's right.
And I was the only kid, I think, in our school, I can remember Mark Potter. Hello, Mark, if you're listening. He had glasses, and one other girl had glasses, and me. And that was from prep to grade 6.
Wow.
And there were big classes, yes, you know, 50 kids in a class.
Yes.
So you got picked on. You got called the old fashioned four eyes, and they'd do dreadful things to, like, you'd be skipping rope and you'd jump in and they'd pull the rope.
Yes.
Yeah, it was really
cruel.
Seen. Yeah, it was cruel and seen as there was something wrong with you if you had glasses. So I made up for it with academia. You know, I'd be top of the class. So the girl with glasses was top of the class.
Yes. Did you have any favourite subjects?
English and history and nature studies. Everything except arithmetic. Right. Anything with a number in it.
Right.
I was okay, but, eight out of 10 wasn't what I wanted. And by the time I got to secondary school and started doing maths, it just completely, I just did not compute. The things I'd learn in Form 1, by Form 5, I'd think, oh, yeah.
It's only started to make sense then, yes.
So I swapped to what they call commercial arithmetic, which was doing banking, basically accountancy. I was all right with that.
Very practical applications.
Yes.
Yes.
Not how to make rocket fuel.
Yes.
I wasn't really interested. But yes, I enjoyed most subjects. Yeah.
The problems you faced in school with the kids, like having the glasses and being young, was that also reflected in your social group outside of school? Were you part of a group of kids? Did you have friends, or was that still the same thing? Kids still picked on you out of school?
I didn't tend to hang around with the kids from school much. Our street was populated by large families. There was a family down the street with 16.
Gosh.
And they were nearly all boys. There was a family up the street with 9, nearly all boys. So I grew up, I was a tomboy.
Right.
And I used to hang out with them. So I learnt to play footy and cricket and how to climb trees and throw stones.
Very important.
Yeah, it was important. You know, and meanwhile the girls were at home playing with dolls and having pretend tea parties, which I just found absolutely the most boring thing to do, especially when there was nothing in the cups. I'd never worked that out.
It was like another cup of tea and there's nothing there.
They'd all say, yes, please, and spend hours doing this. And I'd be much more interested in going to get some tadpoles from the pond, or catch a few frogs, or pick up a few skinks in the garden and look at the lizards, or if we found a wounded bird. And that was always sad because the bird never lived.
No. So you were a very curious child.
Yes, very curious. Very curious. And I'd bring things home.
Oh.
Like any stray dog I happened to find. It followed me home. The old catchphrase. Well, they usually did, but with a lot of coaxing from bits of lunch I had left over.
Oh, yes.
Oh, it must be lost. It's following me.
How did Mum and Dad cope with all that?
It must have driven them to distraction when I think back, but they would put out feelers and usually find the owner of the dog, which was probably about in the next street, or they'd explain to me that puppy belonged to someone else and I had to give it back.
Right.
So they would reason with me. But if it really, really was lost, there were a couple that we did keep. And then learned very early about death, because when the birds died and you'd been feeding it, and well, we got fed so we didn't die, why did the bird die?
Yeah.
They explained about the bird had to be with its mother and it was too young to leave and what would happen to us. So the logic came in so you understood that by keeping the bird, it was better to let Mum and Dad have the birdie and put Birdie in the ground.
Yes.
And it would go to God.
Yeah.
And had a soul and it would live somewhere else.
Yeah.
So that, you know, it was a good foundation for understanding life and death.
Yeah. What age did you leave school?
I left after year 12. Right. Or matriculation.
Matriculation, as it was there. So you were, what, about 17 or something?
16. I was too young.
Oh, that's right, because you started young. That's right.
I'd only just turned 16.
Goodness.
In the October of my year 12. And then I took a break because I was starting to get a bit wild then.
I like that.
Well, I discovered, I lived through the Inform 2, it was 1968, so there were the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Jimi Hendrix.
It was really happening.
It was all happening, yeah. And I had discovered this great love for music, thanks to both my mum and dad, mainly dad, because after the war he made a living out of singing for a while until mum got pregnant with me. But he introduced me to music at a very young age. He would sit me up, and I was that young that he had to hold my back and put me in front of the record player or the stereogram.
Mm-hmm, as it was called.
Or the radiogram.
The radiogram. That's right.
And he had so much music, all different types of music, you know, Judy Garland, all that sort of stuff, Mario Lanza, and he had some classics. So I grew up with music, and by the time I got to second form, I had been playing guitar since I was 8 and singing, and discovered the, I suppose you'd call it, the hippie movement.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I got to year 12...
You were really involved.
I was really involved with thinking, all different types of thinking.
especially thinking, which now we can look back and see as being outside the norm of the day, wasn't it?
Right outside the circle.
Yes, that's right. Our ages aren't dissimilar. And so I can relate to a lot of what you're saying here. But did your parents relate to what's going on? Was there a growing chasm because of this freedom that you were discovering and this whole new way of thinking? Were they able to come along with that, or were they beginning to...
Well, actually, it's an interesting question, because I can't speak for other people, or perhaps, you know, people I grew up with, yes, to a degree. But my parents, it's sort of like they were souls from somewhere else, because given they were born in the 1920s, you would expect a little bit of the Victorianism rubbed off.
Absolutely.
Well, in a strange sort of way, my parents were almost bohemian.
Right.
Because they went along, whether or not it was Dad with the music, he would still listen to what was on the radio and still be able to say, oh, yes, we would agree on a certain tune and we'd go and buy it. And Mum the same. She kept up with everything to a point. They couldn't stand him bringing home Jimi Hendrix, Voodoo Child or something, and having that roaring from the... And by then I had my own little unit.
Yes.
Which, you know, you could crank up.
Yes, yes.
And I had moved out of the house into the bungalow they'd built, so I was really doing the teenage thing.
Oh, yes.
But I still respected them. If they told me to turn it down, I would. If they particularly didn't want me to have something, they would explain why. And I'd think, well, I'll go and listen to it at someone else's place. But they let me have a great degree of freedom. There was a stage between the age of 13 to maybe 16 where Mum would say and tear her hair out and say, I think your father and I have given you too much freedom and it's our fault. And but I respected the freedom they gave me. If they said I could go to a party, as I was back home by 10 o'clock, I'd come home at 10 o'clock. The party would probably just be taking off because they were always older people, but I'd say, I'm sorry, I promised my mum I'd be home at 10 o'clock and I'd go home. So a few times when the parties were way in the bush and someone wasn't able to drive, I wouldn't get back to them. We didn't have mobile phones then.
No, that's right.
Couldn't ring home.
No.
ET call home.
No.
to just... Finding a phone box, probably even now in Cottles Bridge, is probably just as hard as it was then. So yes, to bring Dad to say, come and get me. So you have to wait until somebody was leaving, and that happened a couple of times. But I'd explain it to Mum and Dad, and that was all right.
Mm.
So I respected them giving me that freedom, and I could never understand where they came from, that they were like that.
Mm.
You know?
That isn't the norm, certainly. From my experience, it's not only... Well, I mean, they weren't going to my parents. They were fine. They were supportive. But just listening to other people's stories, they don't gel with that. So your parents were quite unusual in that regard.
They were.
And this is Listen to Older Voices, a program that presents the stories of everyday Australians through the recollection of their lives.
Now, you mentioned that at year 12, around the age of 16, going into 17, you basically, by the sound of it, dropped out.
Well, I finished my secondary learning, and because all the other girls were older than me, well, a lot of them went on to university or teachers' college, and I thought, oh, not more books and more learning. And I was sort of relieved that it was over. I loved school, and it was heartbreaking the last day and everything. But I thought, no. So I got myself a job in what was called the State Bank, and as a clerk there, and I was there for about 18 months. And to be perfectly honest with you, going from one set of rules and structures at where my head was at the time into discipline of, you know, you have to be on the time for work. And I thought it was all going to be just get your pay.
Yeah, that's right.
I got my own wages.
That's
well.
Right.
But no. You had to be at work on time. You had to do what you were told. And so
Very regimented, two banks.
Yes.
Especially in those days.
Extremely
yes.
so. And everything was done manually.
Yes.
Not a computer in sight. So if somebody put a check into the teller, you would invariably end up with it at some point and have to write it in a big ledger. So your handwriting had to be really neat and tidy. And I was the check clerk, so I'd have to add all the checks up every day, and they'd have to tally with what the teller had on his little piece, and lots of handwriting, and it was very hard work. You didn't just push buttons.
No, no.
And we used to count people's pennies. They bring in an ice cream tin full of 1 cent and 2 cent coins.
Because they didn't have a game, didn't have the digital devices to lie and calculate. No.
And and they'd wait. You didn't send them away till the next day. They'd wait on the spot for their $10 note or whatever it was. So it could be very stressful. So I wasn't quite ready for that. So I thought, well, what will I do now? And someone told me about there was a talent show on TV. You could enter the talent quest, and it was Young Talent Time. So I thought, oh, well, I may as well give it a go. So I entered, and I passed the audition and got in and got right through that year to the grand final.
Goodness.
And achievement. Yeah, that was a real experience. And I was in the team when Jamie Redfern was there, and just a year before, the next one coming up through the ranks the following year was Dennis Walter. So it was around about that era when Young Talent Time was really extremely popular, and I ended up with a manager called Evie Hayes.
Yes, very well known.
Yes, well, she was my manager.
Join Robin and I next week and find out why her fabulously successful career falters, and about her attending La Trobe and entering the world of animal welfare. That's next week, part two of the story of Robin Yolton. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Uniting Victoria Tasmania. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.